find this quantity omega t to be this, where omega t is equal to omega naught plus t of omega 1 minus omega naught. So omega t interpolates between two connections where t is a parameter that goes from 0 to 1, then one can show that d by dt of a characteristic polynomial of degree m is equal to m times d of the symmetries of omega 1 minus omega naught of omega t to the m minus 1. And this thing I can call q of 2m minus 1. And it will depend on omega and omega t. So I can choose omega naught equals 0 for simplicity. What I showed last time, actually, maybe I want to do that next. So I showed before that the characteristic class is a topological invariant in the sense that the integral of omega 0 over a manifold is the integral to omega 1 over a manifold. The difference between, it's found by integrating this equation, and the difference between them is the two q's, but by Stokes' theorem, that will vanish. So the integral of over m of p of omega is a topological invariant. And one can rewrite this thing. This is called the Chern-Simons form. And it, q2m minus 1 is equal to the integral of m over t, or m times the integral, sorry, of dt, of the symmetrace of omega with this curvature to the m minus 1. So it's a generalization of what we looked at last week. And one can show that the variation of this object, the gauge variation of this object, is equal to m times m plus 1 times this integral here, the symmetrace of d of that, of that thing. And we could call this thing here the q2m minus 2. So I'll call this q1 of 2m minus 2 of delta omega, omega, big omega. So that generalizes the non-abelian anomaly we had last time. So this is kind of like the abelian anomaly was a special case of this, and the non-abelian anomaly was a special case of that. Non-abelian. And the index theorem. In other words, how do we know what it is? Or
what is it?
Okay, it is some polynomial in the curvature that I have not defined except to say that it is a polynomial. So here, it PM would be the mth term. It is defined contingent on the nature of the operator you're looking at in the index theorem. So I'm going to give a couple of examples in a few minutes. Yeah.
So, I mean, I remember from last time you defined P of omega as the symmetry of omega raised to the power.
Yes. It's. Do you want? Should I write that down?
Is that what you were asking, Jason?
Yeah.
Well, what is P of omega? Pm of omega.
Yeah, it's a polynomial that is closed. I mean, the characteristics of it are that it can be, in principle, any polynomial that is closed and that also is gauge invariant under a gauge transformation. Those are the two things that define it at this stage of the game. So where was I here? Okay, so the index theorem, which is still not obvious, but I'll state what it is. I'm not going to prove it. It's given by this quantity here. So this is not theta, it means the operator. This is something called the Todd class of a manifold. And this is something called, the CH is called the characteristic class of a manifold. This is called the symbol of the operator. And so far, this is just a formal definition. O is some elliptic operator, as mentioned last time. And this is some characteristic polynomial that will be associated with this characteristic of this operator symbol. And one retains, oops, this should say N. One retains the 2n part. In other words, the 2n degree form that is in this expansion. And I would rather flesh this out with a couple of examples to show you how this thing is used in physics instead of attempting to prove it, which I'm not prepared to do here. One example is the index. Oh, great. One example is the index of ID slash, the Dirac operator. It turns out to be the integral of e to the I f over 2 pi, the 2nth term, which means the integral over m of 1 plus I f over 2 pi minus f squared over 2 pi squared plus blah, blah, blah. So this will be f squared to the n over 2 pi to the n plus more if you expand it forever. And the fact that I've got the 2n term means that I ignore everything in this series except that. I take the 2nth term. And this is the non-abelian, the abelian anomaly that we had before. So from the viewpoint of index theory, this would be regarded, when we looked at the path integral, as n plus minus n minus, the number of positive helicity or right-handed zero modes minus the number of left-handed helicity or minus zero modes. That's the definition of the index operator, and basically that's what that sophisticated formula means. If we want to work with RH or left H alone, then we would write ID slash a half is ID slash 1 plus or minus gamma 5. Let's take plus to be specific. So ID slash maps right-handed into left-handed spinners. ID slash a half, sorry. So it doesn't have an index all by itself. Rather, what people do is define this index. In other words, how do we take the number of zero modes? It means number of zero modes of ID slash a half minus the number of zero modes of ID slash a half dagger. And that again turns out to be this same thing. The exponential of the gauge field strength 2 form expanded and retaining only the 2nth term in the series. Yeah.
We wrote P as P inverse omega T. Is that equal to P of omega?
Sorry, can you repeat?
P of G inverse omega G is equal to...
Sorry, that's not zero. My apologies.
And I think there's a 2 pi to 2n.
2 pi to the 2n should be there. You are right. Sharp eye, thank you. So in practice, what happens in physics is these characteristic classes, what happened in physics is people discovered via path integral methods that when you calculated the anomaly, you could understand it to be the difference in zero modes, and you got it to be this certain power of the polynomial. And then mathematicians said, guess what? We've been looking at this thing for quite a while, and this is what it means. And they engaged in further study of it. What is this Todd class? Let's see. Well, another way of writing what I have on there is to say this integral, this index rather, is given this by this integral at the 2nth level. And now I can tell you what all this stuff means. The Todd class of the manifold is simply the product of these things. This Chern class of the symbol is defined to be this different product. I'll say what these things mean in a minute. And because of that theorem up there, the index theorem says that this has to equal this times that. And so you can show that CH of this symbol, sigma just me, it's a mathematical term meaning the symbol of the operator, wedged with this Todd class is equal to the product over A of XA over 2 times the shine of XA over 2 times F. So A hat, these are just different ways of writing the same thing. And I'm aware I haven't told you what X is, just give me a minute. Shine of XA over 2, where, what are the X's? They are the skew eigenvalues of RAB, where this is the curvature. So what it means is we take the curvature matrix I shouldn't have drawn a bracket there because it just goes on and on. I take the curvature matrix in the relevant dimensionality, and because it's anti-symmetric in the A and B indices, I can always write it as, in these indices, as a block diagonal matrix with skew eigenvalues. And the X's are the skew eigenvalues of the curvature tensor. So when you write this thing out in terms of form language, it turns out to be 1 plus a 12th times the trace, oopsie-daisy, the trace of R squared over 4 pi squared. And then there's another term that turns out to be 1 over 4 pi to the 4th times the trace of R squared all squared, plus 1 over 360 trace of r to the fourth, and more. And of course, it's not least, at least to me, not the least bit obvious how this equals that. What you have to do is translate the skew eigenvalues and their products into various traces of that form. So this would be a 4-form, and this would be an 8-form, and so on. So it would be given by this expansion. To give you an example that's different, if you have a Rorita-Schwinger field, which is a spin 3/2 field, then what can be shown is that ID slash of 3/2 is the integral of this A hat characteristic times the trace of e to the I r over 2 pi minus 1 times the characteristic class of f to the 2n, or rather the 2nth part. And this trace is, in skew eigenvalue language, it's equal to twice the sum over a times the cosh of x sub a. And let's see, one other example, and then I think I'll go on to instantons. These things are not things you're going to be able to obviously work out directly. There's a list of references I can give you to show you the details of how they are worked out. Yeah.
The curvature, is that the curvature of the Levi-Civita or connection? Or
it's the curvature of the manifold of M, if it has curvature.
Sorry, is it like Levi-Civita connection or some other connection?
It would be the curvature of the of the omega connection of the manifold. Yes. So the point of showing you this is that there is a relationship between operators. The zero modes of operators of quantum fields and the independent forms of gauge and curvature fields, and they are given by these structures that people have worked out. And from a physics viewpoint, you could work this out with diagrams. It's very tedious, but it has been done. From a mathematics viewpoint, and I'm honestly less familiar with that, there are methods for showing how to calculate the zero modes of these objects in terms of these eigenvalues, which is where all those Todd classes and the A hat thing comes from, and so on. So one other example that's not a fermion, and then I'll go to instantons, and that's an anti-symmetric tensor field. So this is an object whose curl, it has a self-dual curl or a self-dual field strength. So dA is equal to F, which is plus or minus the star of F. That's the self-duality condition. This is the definition of F. But if I require a notion of self-duality, I then have a notion of handedness in index language. This says F mu 1 to mu n is 1 over n factorial, epsilon mu 1 to mu n, epsilon nu 1 to nu n, F nu 1 to nu n times plus or minus 1. And plus is self-dual, and minus is anti-self. Well, maybe I'll put the dual in there. Anti-self-dual. So, yes?
Is A a Lie algebra value here? Or is it
no, it is not. Well, it's not clear how to write one down. This is one of the problems that occurs in string theory when you have these things. You get equations of motion, but the action is not always obvious to write down that it obeys that condition. You can write down an action that is simply the square of this field strength. Just take this thing times itself. So if you have, that's right. So if you have F wedge, so you have to impose this condition at the level of the equations of motion.
Oh, I see.
Right? That's right. That's right. It's a condition on the equation. So, so the index in this case turns out to be the difference in the number of solutions of box F equals 0. So if I take box F equals 0, where the box is the D'Alembertian, then one gets the index of this box operator is minus 1/8 the integral of this thing that's called the Herzebruch. How do I spell Herzebruch? There it is. H-I-R-Z-E-B-R-U-C-H, the Herzebruch signature, which is simply another name for this thing. And it is equal to L is equal to the product of XA over the tanh of XA, where those X's have to do with that same Riemann curvature 2 form. You don't have this concept. I mean, if the manifold is flat, then the index becomes trivial. But if the manifold is not flat, then it's not trivial. And as I say, the physics way, as I said, the physics way of doing this would be, this is in 4K plus 2 dimensions. The physics way of doing this would be to calculate diagrams. There was a very long paper in the 80s by Alvarez Gomez and Witten that calculated all of these different kinds of anomalies. Just a second, physics in physics language using diagram. This one, the ones over there, and so on. And there is another paper. by, so the two, if you really want to dig deep into this, and then I'll get to Deborah's question. If you really want to dig deep in this, you can look at Annals of Physics, 161, 1985, page 423, or Nuclear Physics B, 234, 1983, page 269. And there are other references as well. I guess I can let Tibra show you, but what I wanted to point out here that I didn't get to last time is simply that there, all of these anomaly structures can be understood as differences of zero modes of one kind of helicity and another, and in every case, they can be related to topological properties either of the manifold or of the gauge field strength, or both.
The index of the box operator, if that is a topological invariant, why should it depend on whether the manifold is curved or not?
Well, it will depend on the skew eigenvalues of the curvature, which I guess I should have said on the topological properties of the manifold, because those eigenvalues will care about that, so whether it's got handles or holes or something. Those eigenvalues care about that. If RAB is zero, this is zero. And then you don't, there's nothing interesting on a flat manifold for this particular case. Yeah, for this particular case. This one doesn't care about fermions or gauge field strength. This one cares only about curvature. The other ones care about both in general, though in all of the examples we did up to today, we had triviality in the curvature. So here the triviality in the curvature basically makes this thing equal to one, and you get the Chern class, which is that exponential up there. For Rarita Schwinger, or the Gravitino as it's called, if the curvature is zero, well, this is one, but this cancels that, and then you don't get anything. Yeah.
The other thing is, for Weyl anomaly, can we also do that in terms of zero modes of?
Yes. Yeah. That one's a bit different. That's a scale invariant. I should be actually hold back on that. The Weyl anomaly is connected with topological structure, but not with handedness in the same way. It's a scale, it basically says quantum effects destroy scale invariants. So I want to go on to instantons. I think we've probably, had enough about anomalies, unless there are other questions. But I hope you've got to see, can appreciate the lay of the land a bit more from this, and have some basic methods that show you how these things are calculated. These things were pivotal in convincing the at least particle physics community, and I guess by extension, much of theoretical physics, that string theory was very important, because when anomalies were looked at, it was the paper on gravitational anomalies that I think inspired Green and Schwartz to say, well, we've got this funny string theory and we think it has a graviton in the spectrum. What would happen if we calculate the anomalies in this? And that's what they did in the mid-1980s, right after this thing came out, and they found this result that the gravitational anomalies and all the other ones, when you scattered strings off strings where the strings had special chirality, would only cancel for a particular choice of the gauge group. And no one had ever seen that before. So this suggested specialization in nature from very fundamental reasons of symmetry. Unfortunately, fortunately or not, depending on your viewpoint, the specialization turned out to be generalization as it was studied more closely, but that wasn't known 30 years ago. All right, so another feature that comes into standard model physics that goes beyond the usual are instantons. So how many of you have used or looked at instantons before? Not many. Okay. Well, an instanton is associated with the quantum phenomenon of tunneling. And basically, it's a way of understanding quantum tunneling in the context of gauge theories. So we'll start off with what I hope is more familiar territory. Suppose I have some kind of potential barrier. So here's V, here's X, and suppose I give a particle this much energy. Well, we all know that classically there's no way of getting from here to there or from here to there. We roll a ball up a hill, it'll roll back down, for example. But quantum mechanically, we also know that a particle can tunnel through that barrier. If you send a particle in as a wave from this side, some of it will get reflected, but some of it can get transmitted. And the, what in my view is still remarkable feature of nature, that we have the wave is also a particle, so I can see a particle here and then literally see it reappear on the other side of a wall. So the answer for the amplitude for tunneling is A, which is equal to the integral, oopsie daisy, e to the minus 1 over h bar times the integral from xi to xf of dx, where are we? The square root of twice v minus e times 1 plus terms of order h bar that correct this process. This is the, this comes out from the usual WKB approximation. It's semi-classical, and it's not entirely analytic. We can't take h bar to 0 here, because this doesn't have a well-defined series expansion near 0. But we do see familiar features. If v and e were constants, then this integral would just be the square root of 2v minus e times the difference in the x's, which tell us that thick barriers make tunneling harder and large potentials make tunneling harder unless you give it a lot of energy near the potential. That makes tunneling easier, right? This is familiar physics. If you wham it and you're just up here, you're probably going to get through. But if you've got a tiny bit of energy, you're probably not going to get through. And if you got an enormously wide barrier, you're probably not going to get through. Okay. So what I want to do is look at this using different methods to get the same thing, to get you used to what the idea of an instanton is. So is that okay? Any questions? All right. So let's consider the following situation. I've got x final, e to the minus ht over h bar on x initial. In Euclidean space. So let's pretend I have quantum theory, but I've rotated the time into an imaginary direction. Then in the path integral formalism, this is what I get, where S is equal to the integral from minus t over 2 to t over 2 of L, which is the integral of minus t over 2 to t over 2 of the familiar a half mx dot plus v. Now, what about the plus v integrated over t? That's because we're in Euclidean space. there's an additional minus sign that comes in the Lagrangian over here. I guess I should have written it down here. So Lagrangian here is a half mx dot squared minus v. When you let t go to it, this becomes minus. So it's minus the sum of these two things. And that's what ends up giving you that, yeah. Yes, this is a normalization factor that I will discuss momentarily. That is simply a way, I don't have to have it there, but that's a way to denote that I'm integrating over all possible paths. So this is paths, path integral. And I sometimes like to do it to remind me it's not the normal dx of calculus. It's the dx over all the possible paths. So xf of t, or rather x of t over 2 is what I mean by x final, and x of negative t over 2 is what I will mean by x initial. So I'll set my clock such that the initial starting point is at negative t over 2, and the final end point is positive t over 2. I could always do that if I so desired. Where was I? So let's write x of t to be x bar of t plus cn xn of t, where these xn's are a complete orthonormal set. If you integrate them over time in the allowed range of t, I'm going to get a delta function. And furthermore, by the boundary conditions, these things vanish at both endpoints. In other words, I've got x bar at plus or minus t over 2 is equal to xf or xi if it's positive and that if it's negative. So in other words, I'm going to rewrite this as some function that will obey the boundary conditions, plus the sum over a bunch of other functions that obey this orthonormality condition. So the reason for doing that is that the path integral, or rather the measure of the path integral, becomes the product over the DCNs over 2 pi h bar to the 1/2, if you look in a book like Feynman and Hibbs. And so let me call this star. So the right-hand side of star is equal to this normalization factor times, of course, this integral over all these c's times e to the minus s of x of t divided by h bar. And so what am I doing about h bar? Well, I'll assume that this solves delta s. Can you guys see that, or should I write, is this visible? I'll assume this solves delta s delta x equals 0. In other words, this is the classical solution. And so the whole idea of the path integral is you take what you anticipate is a normal classical solution that exists, and then you wiggle it all over the place. And that's basically what these things do. And then in classical physics, you see what minimizes that. In quantum physics, you add up over all the possible paths it could take from initial to final, and that's what this is parameterizing here. And that's what you're adding up over. So if we do that, then S of x of t is equal to S of x bar plus, if I expand in the t's, the integral of d by dt, the sum of cn, xn, delta s, delta x, at x equals x bar, and we've already said that's zero by definition. And so then the next term in the series is the integral, the next term in the series, so the leading term for s will be x bar, and because it's minimized at x bar, this will vanish. So continuing to expand about x bar, I'll get the sum over n and m of cn xn delta squared s delta x squared at x bar, evaluated at x bar, times cm xm dt dt prime. And of course, I will get more terms in the series as I continue. So now what we want to do in fact, this is nice. I even have, I think I'll even write on this here and take advantage of this additional board space. So we have that first term vanishes in the series. So what does that mean? Well, delta S delta X evaluated at X bar is minus m d squared x bar by dt squared plus v prime evaluated at x bar. And we already said this thing has to be zero because x bar extremizes the action. So we know that this tells us that m dx bar by dt squared minus v of x bar is a constant of the motion. Now, this is nothing more than saying the kinetic energy plus the potential energy is a constant of the motion, except remember, we live in Euclidean land. So T is imaginary, and so we get a sign difference here when you work that out. It's sort of backwards. The action is kinetic plus, or the Lagrangian is kinetic plus potential, but the energy's kinetic minus potential, because the kinetic energy is a funny kind of kinetic energy. So what about this second derivative? Well, I'd have delta x of t1, delta x of t2, when I take this derivative. And that will be an operator, if I take the variation of that thing, that will be minus m d squared by dt squared plus v double prime at x bar. And this will act on this Kronecker delta function. If you expand this out, this comes in here because there's only two powers of x. So if I take a double variation, I've got to get a Kronecker delta. And then the v double prime term basically will give you the same thing. Higher terms will have derivatives of delta or more derivatives of delta coming into play. So let's choose these xms to be eigenfunctions of this, that delta squared, delta x squared at x bar of xm is lambda m xm. In which case this expansion simplifies to S of x bar plus 1 over 2 factorial, the sum over nm of cn, cm, lambda m, xn of t, xm of t, dt, plus terms of the order of c squared. And integrated over t, which means this is just s of x bar plus 1 over 2 factorial cn, cm, lambda m, plus other stuff. I mean order c cubed. You're absolutely right. Sorry.
Do we always have this freedom to choose it like that?
Do we always have this freedom? No, it's not always entirely clear that we would. You might concoct an action otherwise, but I'm going to assume there are certainly cases where we do and see what happens. Right.
So over there we had two integrals over t and t prime.
Yeah, but this is giving you a Kronecker delta, so when you integrate over one of them, you get the other. Okay, so so this tells me that I've got x final e to the minus ht over h bar, x initial. If I look at that quantum amplitude, this is giving the n e to the minus action evaluated at h bar, evaluated at x bar, sorry, times pi m times 1 over this thing to get the dimensions right, times pi n of lambda inverse 2 pi h bar to the 1 half, times 1 plus terms of order h bar. But this determinant, this product of lambdas, is simply the determinant of this, which is the determinant of that. So the product of the lambdas is just by definition the determinant of minus dt squared plus v double, I guess it's minus m, although that m is the mass, not the product over those other m's. So this cancels that, and what we end up with is that this is n times e to the minus s of x bar over h bar times the determinant of minus dt squared plus v double evaluated at x bar all to the minus a half times some correction of order h bar. Let's just set equal to 1, or if we want, we could absorb it into the definition of the time for simplicity. So what about this normalization factor? You can show, and I'll mention how much, yeah, I think I can do that. You can show, let me write down what you do first, minus dt squared plus v double at x bar of t, of course, minus some quantity lambda is equal to 2 pi h bar x lambda at t over 2, capital T over 2, to the negative a half evaluated at lambda equals 0. This is, I guess I better call that double star. And the reason for this is the following. The reason for this is the following. If you consider this equation here, suppose we have minus dt squared plus v double acting on some quantity I'll call x sub lambda, and suppose I call that lambda x sub lambda. In other words, I'm just writing out that eigenvalue equation over there on the other board, and I want x.
Why do you have two products? Should you have a product over m, and should there just be the product?
Because one is the, let's see, when I take, where is it on the board?
It's about the top board, right?
So, so you have it in the measure. So there's a product in the measure, which I have a whole bunch of those. I've got 2 pi h bar multiplied a bunch of times, which is as many as c's. And then I integrate over all the c's. And the integral over the pair of the c's is what gives me a determinant under certain conditions I haven't yet specified, but I will in a minute. So if I write out this, sorry? Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So let's see. X lambda of negative t over 2 is equal to 0, and let's say dx lambda dt of negative t over 2 is equal to 1. Otherwise, I can't get anything interesting if they're both 0 if I go to large t. So this acts on functions that vanish at either end by the previous requirements. Actually, let me do it that way. So it has solutions provided that I have x lambda of provided the other boundary condition is obeyed. Let's x sub lambda sub n. In other words, there will be particular lambdas for which this has a solution, and they will only exist provided the boundary condition at the other end is satisfied. And then if I have two, I was really hoping to fit this all on one board. Shall I go? All right, I guess I'll have to just do the other one down. Oops. So if I, this implies that the determinant of dt squared plus v double a minus lambda over the determinant of dt squared plus v double b minus lambda is equal to xa lambda of t over 2 divided by xb lambda of t over 2. And why is that? This is for two potentials, a and b, or va VA and VB. So why on earth should that be right? Well, so this should be XA is associated with VA, XB is associated with VB, but each side is a meromorphic function of lambda. Each side is a meromorphic function of the value lambda having same poles and the same zeros. So why is that? Each side approaches one, oopsie-daisy, as lambda approaches infinity, that side approaches one, and that side approaches one. As lambda goes to infinity, this gets giant compared to this, so it's unity, and these eigenvalues will likewise, or eigenfunctions will likewise have to approach unity. So the ratio of, so you've got the ratio of functions that approach unity at both sides that have the same analytic structure. So this implies, I'm putting too much notation here on the board. Let me write it separately, it gets confusing. X lambda T over 2A over X lambda B T over 2 approaches 1 as lambda goes to infinity. And likewise, the determinants also approach 1. As lambda approaches infinity. So you've got two functions that have the same zeros and poles and also approach the same value. So that's why you have to get equality between these ratios, because remember, this is equal to that and this is equal to that by the eigenvalue equation. So in other words, the determinant of minus dt squared plus v double minus lambda all divided by x lambda of t over 2 is equal to some constant. And so I will choose the normalization such that I satisfy that constant constraint. So this implies that I can choose n times the determinant of minus dt squared plus v double minus lambda is equal to this 2 pi h bar x lambda t over 2 to the negative 1/2. And I'll take the limit as lambda goes to 0 and set that equal there. So what I've done, I'm out of time, and this might look a bit obscure, but what's going to happen when I use this normalization criterion is we're going to recover the WKB result that is hidden under here. At least I hope it is. Yes, we're going to, oh no, it's up there, sorry. We're going to recover that WKB result using this technology, and I'll give a few examples next time. And you might ask, why on earth are we going through all this? Because WKB is easier. Well, yes, it is easier than this method for this structure, But these methods are completely transferable to gauge theories where the WKB methods are not easily useful or applicable. And that will allow us to understand how gauge fields can tunnel from one kind of low energy gauge state to another kind of low energy state, yielding things like the theta vacuum and QCD, the issues with the U1 problem and all this kind of stuff. So I will give a couple of examples next time to show how we get from this point back to the WKB result. Yes.
Two questions. What's the double star and what happened to N?
The double star was simply to remind me that was an important equation that allows me to recover. The double star is just this. I was going to use it later, but I didn't bother, so it doesn't matter.
And what happened to N? You just said it to be...
Well, N is going to be defined by this relationship. This will tell us what N is, because I know what this is, and I, in principle, know what those are. So this tells me what these things are. So in other words, N times this determinant is going to be given by this product over these things.
So you're implying that the minus squared plus B double prime has complex analytic eigenfunctions and complex eigenvalues?
In lambda space, yes. If I assume lambda, I'm assuming actually for the purposes of physics, lambda will be positive. But for the purpose of demonstrating this, I can use complex analysis to say, what if we analytically continue lambda to complex variables? Then you can show that the ratio of those has to have the same zeros and poles, and they both approach the same limit for large lambda. So then it has to be the same function. Any two meromorphic functions that have that property are there. But what we're interested in physics, you're absolutely right, are real lambda. It's just the complex analysis shows that this works. That's all.
So then you restrict yourself to functions that are necessarily analytic, right? So that's a big restriction if you're just looking at real functions.
Well, yes, to some extent that's right, but that's sufficient for the WKB thing I want to do. But sure.